Hey everyone, Scott Stevenson here. My new book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, is out. You can get it at byobbcoach.com as well as Amazon and Barnes & Noble internationally.
Advices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, of course, is Dr. Scott Stevenson. As always, man, how you been?
I've been good. I've been busy.
Yeah?
Traveling man, back and forth to see my mom, and then up to Tampa, and then back and forth. So, as I mentioned last time, I had my dad's funeral, and then back to Tampa, and then I'm leaving, going to, I've just been back and forth like multiple times.
Wow.
So yeah, the van, the dogs are traveling pups.
Wow.
The van.
That's good. Do they travel pretty well?
It's funny. Yesterday, I was actually out with my mom. We went to the Philharmonic. She had a, actually she bought some tickets to go with my dad, and that's not possible. So I went with her.
Oh, that was sweet really of nice. You.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to do as much as I can. And so I was out late. The reason I mentioned that is I was out at a time of night when usually I'm not. So the dogs, when they see that, like sometimes when I'm coming in and out or there's something weird with the time schedule, that usually means I'm getting ready. We're getting ready to go somewhere and do something. And I arrived home. They're all riled up. And Foxy, who my newest one, my little escape artist, she runs out and she runs right to the van.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like literally. I'm like, oh, shit, what did she see? But it was nothing. It was just that she wanted to get in the van.
That's funny.
Yeah, there she goes. Just when we start to talk, she's barking. They're having a little bit of a bone war over there.
That's funny, man.
Yeah, so they love to travel. Suki, not so much. I have to pick her up and put her in every time.
Okay.
And she sits right next to me. It's very, very cute. I put her Thunder shirt on her.
Aw.
Yeah, she has a little pink Thunder shirt.
So last episode, you challenged everybody to do something different. Do something different that you don't normally do in your life. And that resonated with me. I did a lot of different things that day.
Cool.
That's cool. For sure. Not all of them by choice, but a lot of different stuff went down. And I've taken that with me because, you know, it is important, I think, to remember that, to be able to keep living. And I think I might have talked with you about this once before, but I know I've talked about it on a couple of the shows. And Scott, I don't know what kind of science is behind this. I don't know where it came from, but it makes a ton of sense to me. So guys, bear with me if you've heard me say this before, but when you do things that you've always done, your brain doesn't record as much information. And so that time goes by faster. Like if you work at the same place every day, your drive to work, you can get there sometimes and be like, huh, how did that happen? You know, or when you're 40 years old, the summer goes by real fast versus when you're a kid, summer lasts forever. And it's the number of new things that are coming into our brain that forces us to pay more attention to what's going on in life. And that's the way you live life. So you can either live life and miss an entire season, or you can make each day special. And that's what it reminded me to do, was to make each day special and get the most out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's so easy, you know, with our 9-to-5 work schedules that most people kind of have to adhere to. And you take the same route to work because it's the fastest one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so easy to automatize our world. and miss out on so many different little things that, that just will pass us by. And I'm glad that that resonated so well with you. That's a totally fun thing to do. I mean, literally, just it can it, at first it can be if you're not used to that, a little bit of like a little overwhelming because you're like, oh, I had this assignment, I have to like I got this extra thing that I've got sort of weighing on me to do. But it's not meant to be that. It's like my assignment is to be kind of a goofball and do something really kind of silly and stupid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it could be even like, you know, you just go and. One person I heard back from, who I'm sure will be listening, he went and bought a homeless person a lunch on a really crappy day.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, which I thought was really cool. That's something I've done in the past too, and had a life transforming conversation, many years ago. Yeah, that I won't forget. But, it could be just like something just outrageously silly. You buy a silly hat at the gas station you go to all the time.
Yeah.
And you walk to work wearing like, you know, the Christmas reindeer antler hat, you know, and people are like, what are you doing? Like you come in, you say the same things every day, you know, you're like Mr. Automaton here. And all of a sudden you do something crazy. That'll completely change how people interact with you and your perspective on things. I mean, how we dress can totally change our mood.
Sure. You know? Sure.
And I've had friends and one girlfriend in particular who was very, very keenly aware of that, that, you know, how she dressed, totally impacted sort of her perspective, how she sees herself. And so she was very, very careful in what she wore, based on where she's going, what she's doing. And if she felt like she needed like a little bit of a pick me up. Guys don't do that nearly as much, but
yeah,
we can. So, you know, that could be one thing. You just decide to just do like wear something different. That's kind of strange and for you or unusual for you. And it'll just completely color your day in a different way.
You know, you said something that, it made me think more. You said, you wear that hat into work and it changes how people interact with you.
Oh, absolutely.
So much of who we are is based on the people that we're around. And, you know, the people that are close to us, they have an idea of who we are and how to react to us, how to interact with us and what we're going to say or do next. And I think that can be good. That can be comforting in life at times, but it can also hold us back and keep us in the box of who we've always been. So I think that, making new friends is another really great way to embrace being the person that you want to be. Because if you look at like back in the day, they would have like bowling leagues and knitting circles, right?
And I know it's a bowling leagues. I don't know. Knitting. They have knitting circles. I was a member of a knitting group on Facebook at one point.
Of course you were. Of course you were.
I was added by someone. I didn't.
What did you make?
I'd made nothing. I was, she was someone who was the wife of someone who worked for Lead FTS, right? Yeah. He still does, and she just added me to the group. I'm like, okay, I'll just like whatever.
I thought you were gonna say you were just there to hit on chicks.
Nope. I didn't meet a single person that one. No.
Surprise.
There you go. You go hang out at the library to meet women, you know, you go join all the knitting circles to meet women on Facebook.
Yes. Yes. Well, right? You know, though, by meeting new people, you know, you say like you wanted to be a comedian. you could tell your family, you could tell your friends.
You're saying I'm not a comedian already? You're saying I'm not funny?
Professionally.
Oh, okay.
And your friends might be like, well, you know, you're funny, Scott, but you're not that funny.
Right.
If you meet new people who don't already have that prefab notion of who you are, and you could say, hey, I want to be a comedian, then guess what? Guess what that person knows you as? That you're the guy who wants to become a comedian. And it allows you that window to continue actualizing what you want to be in life. You know, you're not necessarily stuck in who you've always been and in the trappings of that, which is great to have, you know, your close friends and family, but it's nice to be able to have people in your life that will allow you to become who you want to be too. So I'm going to extend that to not only trying new things, but to meet new people. And for that reason.
Yeah. You can prime people and even kind of prime yourself to be able to sort of take on whatever aspect of your personality that you like to bring forth the most.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I just had an interaction with my neighbor whose grandson was over. So he was coming around the back and the dogs were barking. One of my dogs was barking like there's someone there who she didn't know. Anyway, it was the grandson who hadn't really greeted the dog. So I went up to see who it was and we talked and he introduced me as Dr. Scott, which I don't think he's ever done before.
Okay.
But I noticed that he put doctor in front of my name.
Doctor.
And I really am not, I mean, you do it for the show and people, you know, that has become more common now, but I'm really not terribly in favor of that at all.
Yeah.
Because it creates a blockade. I mean, like doctor, okay, what are you a doctor of? Like you're somebody who's smart, who maybe knows some shit I don't.
Yeah.
One of my best friend's a therapist and she avoids at all costs telling people she's a therapist because they immediately associate that with holy shit, she can read my mind and she knows how fucked up I am.
Yeah.
And like, I can't, it's like everything's Freudian, you know, I can't like drink water from a straw because I have some, you know, phallic
right. type of
occupation and preoccupation. And so she has to be very careful. But yeah, if you walk up to someone and tell them you do one thing, they'll begin attributing all sorts of things to you or not questioning things you might say. It's like, oh, he's a doctor.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, like doctor of what? So yeah, you can. And the thing that occurred to me when you're talking there too is speaking of parents, like we all take on different aspects of our personality depending on the social context, what's appropriate. You know, there's certain things you do in an elevator that you, you know, that are just sort of the basic social norm, and depending on who you're with, and then your history with that person. And it took me a long while. You know, I had a role as a child in my family of origin. I may even talk about this before, kind of as the perfect child who just kind of, you know, is never going to be a burden or a worry to his parents. And that was kind of my role.
I remember saying that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it took me, you know, probably into my 30s to kind of be more of an authentic version of me. With my parents when we're out doing things. And it's always been funny. Still, it comes back to this day. Like my nickname in college was Rowdy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And, so when my parents came to visit, like there was a parents' day, maybe my senior year they came for, and then there's graduation. They have parents of some of my best friends come up and say, oh, you must be Rowdy's parents.
That's funny.
My parents were like, who? And like they would ask questions like it's really kind of amazing that he made it through in 4 years. They're like, what? Why would you say that? They had no idea the crazy shit I was up to in college.
Oh my gosh.
Because, you know, and I did some pretty crazy things in high school too, but they didn't have any idea. So like there are so many aspects of my personality that wouldn't come out with my parents, and that's like the perfect Ram Dass is kind of a woo-woo-y guru kind of guy that maybe a lot of people listening,
yeah,
listening have heard of. And maybe you know who Ram Dass is?
I've heard the name.
Yeah. He had another Christian name. I can't remember what it is right now, but okay. He was sort of part of the LSD craze way back when, Timothy Leary, all those guys. But he's been quoted as saying something like, if you think you're enlightened, spend a weekend with your parents.
Hmm.
And like you can be the most calm, patient person, but your parents and your family will totally throw you for a loop.
Oh, they can
totally trip you out, and you will see how different you behave and react and manifest in terms of your personality when you're with your family. So that's like a perfect, if you don't believe what you and I are talking about right now, anyone who's listening,
yeah,
you know, just compare how you are with your buddies versus how you are with your, can you tell your mom a dirty joke? Like really, that you might tell your friends? You know, that's a perfect example of how different you can be with different people.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and my point with the bowling leagues and knitting circles was it was a lot easier then to physically go to places where you could meet those people that knew you, but still had the room in their minds to let you become who you wanted to be. I think it's a little bit more of a challenge in some ways to physically meet people today. Absolutely. And be able to do that. But, you know, I mean, we've got the internet, which everybody kind of just invents who they want to be anyway for that, right?
It's absolute fantasy. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to get past their phones, you know, before you can meet someone.
Yeah.
I guess maybe a good opening line would be, hey, I wonder if you have an app recommendation for X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you can start with the phones as a, you know, as a bridge for conversation. But, yeah, I totally agree with you that. So I'm glad that you did that. I heard from just a couple people who followed up and did something new and different.
Yeah. What kind of things have they done?
Food and, like, literally it was just two people, I think. And then what you had told me.
Okay.
Yeah, there was just one Russian food and what'd the other person tell me? I think it was food. I'm blanking on it right now.
Hmm.
And then, you know, food for a homeless person.
Okay.
Food, yeah.
No kidding. That is cool that they did that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think so too.
I had a question for you, and this is regarding your new book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. So I'm about to buy the hardcover edition. And when I searched it, it came up on Amazon. There was I tried to recreate that. I searched it again, actually. And when I did that, it just came up the way it just comes up as hardcover $100, Kindle $75. But when I, let's see, here it is. So, okay. When I clicked new, and I see it from Firehouse Liquidation for $99.99. And Amazon Prime, and then PB Shop USA for $104, $107 mm-hmm. from Prep Books, at various prices, all the way up to $117, $129, $178, $59. You got to get that $59 in there, and that's ships from DC, Canada,
mm-hmm.
from ZZ's, in case you guys wanted to spend an extra $78.59. You get free shipping, though, so there's that. Yeah. How do I know that I'm in this is a legit question. I figured I'd save it for the show.
Yeah, sure.
Cause I have the PDF version, but I wanted the hardcover. I needed to wait until I had a little bit of money that I could pick it up. How do I know that I'm going to get it from you if I go through Amazon?
Well, in your case, Scott, you should have just told me that you're up to this and I'll just send you one.
Well, that's the thing is that's the reason I didn't want to tell you because
I know
I appreciate what you're doing and the book is of value. So I want to be able to support that. If there's something I can freaking do in my life, it's support the people that I believe in. You know, I was talking to Vijay about the other day about how we vote with our money and where we spend it. And so I try to be careful. You know, the longer I've done bodybuilding, the more conscientious I am with where I put my money because there's certain things I don't want to support. And instead of going on and on about that stuff, what we do at Advices is I talk about the things I do believe in and I do support. And of course, you and your stuff is a big part of that. So yeah, how do I make sure I get this from you?
I think, as far as I know, because I wasn't expecting that to happen, but it happens with all books is that I'm not sure how those people can claim new. Maybe it's, you know, I imagine they're buying it from Amazon or Barnes and Noble. So those sales go to me. As far as I know, the hardcover sales go to me. There's only one source for printing the books and they're distributed through Amazon and Barnes and Noble.
Okay.
And all those other booksellers are just reselling books. And maybe, I don't know exactly how it is that they can like charge more than 100 and expect to make a profit. It could be with people that don't have Amazon Prime. Hmm. So they just buy like one copy. And these booksellers may buy like one copy of, you know, hundreds of thousands of books maybe to make available. And then if someone who doesn't have Amazon Prime wants to buy the book and they can get it with free shipping as opposed to having to pay regular shipping because they're not an Amazon Prime member, then they would get from the book reseller. Okay. So, I wouldn't buy the 117. I actually know someone who bought it for like 85 once, and it wasn't used.
Hmm.
I don't know how that happened. Maybe they had it for so long they're like, well, we just need to get rid of it. And, but so I don't know. I think if you buy the hardcover, I'm pretty certain that there's like the, no one's printing it out and making like contraband version hardcover.
I just want to make sure I got it directly instead of buying it from somebody else who's selling it. So if I just go to Amazon Prime and I get it directly from Amazon, that's the route. Or Barnes and Noble?
Or Barnes and Noble. I think literally, as far as I know, there's a few places where they print the book.
Okay.
And there's like if someone is selling the book, then they bought it and I benefited from them having purchased it.
Okay.
Yeah. So the money coming back to me because someone bought the book. And if you buy it for that book reseller, then you know I still have profited because they bought it from Amazon or Barnes and Noble, which got it from the people who do the print on demand for me.
I gotcha.
So
okay.
Yeah. So it's in the chain.
I just wanted to be clear about that.
Yeah. Now the online one, I should probably mention that to get interested in seeing what people think, because I'm getting like weekly sales reports on the PDF that tell me that like literally only about 10% of people who go all the way to adding the book to their cart, like 90% abandon the cart, which I think I've looked around. I don't know. I think that's a pretty high abandonment rate. My guess is that because you can see the price when you go look at it. It's not like it's but maybe it's when it's right in their face after they add it to their cart or they go to, you know, buy it on PayPal, what have you. They're like, you know, I know I could get this thing cheaper for these pirated versions. They just do that. So what I'm thinking I might do, which I hadn't done, although some people have thought that I had, is just like I have for the Fortitude Training book. And this is what I want to get feedback on from anyone who posts on Instagram or Facebook after we put the podcast up, is give people who buy the book free access to my discussion board, where I've been answering questions for years now daily. Okay. And that way there would be some value. The extra $40 would give you basically is a sort of a lifetime subscription to that discussion board, as long as I can keep it running and I'm still around to do so. I'll be answering questions. And
I like that. I like that idea.
Yeah, because it's just like if it's like 90, like that's a shit ton of books that these. And you know, what it is too, Scott. It's not that like, oh God, I want all that money. You know, it would be nice, of course. And I think there's obviously logical grounds for that money coming to me.
Sure.
But it's more so that these guys have just. I think I know how they got hold of that. The copy that's probably being sold. It's just a PDF, so they're just sending out the same file, and that those people. They're doing that to me, and they're doing that to thousands of other authors.
Mm.
It's just so wrong.
Yeah.
It's just such a, and I emailed those folks. I heard back from one of them. I said, oh, yeah, no problem. We'll take it down. They don't do it. They won't do anything. So it's just such a, it's just the intellectual theft there is just, it's not that they're distributing it for free and people are getting it without buying, but they're actually profiting on it.
Yeah.
And they're, from what I can tell, they're making, they're making like probably if you add it all up, they're probably making four times as much money as I am overall. That's just judging by abandoned carts.
Yeah.
And there's so you add that up and like literally probably 90% of what should be going to me is going to them. And it's not that so much that I'm missing out, it's that these guys. It's just pure thievery. It's they're book pirates. And they're the worst of the worst as far as that's really bad. So I like to try to like get people involved. And then I think it'll help more people use the book too. Cause some people aren't quite sure what to do and that they bought the book for that reason. And if they have questions, they're pretty much just like with the Fortitude Training book, they'll be in there, but there will always be questions. And there'll always be a chance to help somebody.
Right.
Oh, it'll help me fulfill my mission of helping more people if I do it that way. So I just need to make sure I've got an easy way to add them into the board with a free subscription.
Oh, yeah.
Given the evidence, because you could buy the hard copy, you could buy the Kindle or the PDF. So once I make sure I've got that wired in easily, then I can do that. But I want to hear if people like that idea.
That's cool. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. You don't really get that opportunity where you can read a book and then ask the author questions. So I think that it's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I had a guy he messaged me. He wanted to do a phone consult, and he just wanted me to like look over his diet that he had And I'm like, dude, just get on my board. Just I'll get on the board and I'll answer your question. And he was going to pay me like a normal consultation. I could have phone consultations with people and we would just like kind of shoot the bull for an hour and I'd make a lot of money. But I would just prefer to help as many people as I possibly can for the, make it as cheap for them as possible. Cause a lot of bodybuilders don't have a whole lot of money. And he's like, I still want to do a phone consult with you. It would just be so cool. And like, I'm like, so just for the coolness sake? He's like, yeah. It's like, he doesn't have any more questions. I'm like, well, I'm not going to take your money. Just go post your diet up and I'll help you out on the board. So that's what we did. That happens cool. All the time. That's what I like to do as much of as possible.
That's cool. One of our listeners was out here in Detroit, this week. Yeah.
See you just because you're so cool.
Yeah. No. Oh, okay. I'm not that cool, Scott.
Just for the coolness of it. All right.
Yeah. I want to give him a shout out. His name is Sean. I'm not going to say his last name because he is, he told his job that, he was sick. so that he could come to Detroit to interview for another job, but he, okay. Yeah. So I, times. Yeah. So shout out to him. He's here. He trained at the original Detroit powerhouse this morning, and his advice is radio tank top. So he looked like he worked up a good sweat, and he got a good workout in at a good gym. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just made me think about reaching out to people and whatnot. So I wanted to give him a shout out. What do you say we take a quick break, Scott? We got a bunch of questions and stuff over at the board and a lot more to talk about. But I figure this would be a good time to get to some fortitudetraining.net. What do you say?
Okay, here we go.
All right, guys, we'll be back in just a minute.
If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson. Hey guys, Scott McNally here.
And this is VJ Peary.
You guys know us from here at the Advices Radio Network. Well, we also have another show, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. We've got everything from supplement reviews
to shout outs,
listener questions,
and of course, our weekly bodybuilding podcast reviews.
So check us out every Friday.
Or whenever you feel like cooking or doing your cardio or basically wasting time with us.
You can hear us at bodybuildingnerds.com.
Also on iTunes. Bodybuilding Nerds, it's time to get nerdy. Not being scared if you
never please me. You know you really want to play. All right, guys, and we are back. Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. And we're over at the message board. Guys, if you want to answer or ask questions, we would be thrilled to have you ask them over at forum.advicesradio.com, or you could just go to advicesradio.com and there's a button for the forum. You can go there. In the bodybuilding section, there are threads for all the shows. We are in the Muscle Minds thread. And this question is from Barry Swole. He says, question for Dr. Scott. I think it was episode 32 where he discusses MK677 not increasing IGF past a certain amount of time, like 7 to 10 days. I stumbled across this research done on an aging population that shows MK677 increasing IGF-1 at 2 and 4 weeks into the study. At 4 weeks in, was higher than 2 weeks results, and the majority of the subjects had IGF-1 levels of a 21 to 25 year old male. Any thoughts? I'm just curious because I've been using this protocol like a poor man's GH with several clients. And then he cites the study. I know you've got a chance to look at that. This is one I'm very interested in too, Scott, because you got me hesitant to use MK. And you got me hesitant to suggest anybody use it at this point. I would say that in my personal experience, I felt like in this, I'm holding my hand up in air quotes here, I didn't do lab work. I felt like it was doing something. I felt like I was getting better quality sleep and maybe better appetite, fluid retention, all that stuff. But I just felt like, I heard episode 32 just ringing in the back of my head. So I'm glad that Barry asked this one.
Yeah. So, it definitely increases, the long-term studies show with, I think, the 25 milligram dose, that it increases IGF-1 like 1.6 to 1.8 times past the baseline, something like that. That's roughly what you find. So he was talking about 2 versus 4 weeks, and I pulled up that study, and that is what happens. IGF-1 changes very, very slowly. So that's not really that big of a deal to me, to be honest, to see. This is, I'm looking at the values right now. The percent change was just about 80 at 4 weeks. It was just about 80% above the baseline in terms of IGF-1, which is pretty much what you find in all the studies that I've looked at. So it just takes some time for IGF-1 to be elevated. The thing that's pretty interesting, and there's another study, this study he's talking about, the first author was Chapman, and there's another study, like which one it is, it could be the Svensson study. There's only a few of them that are long-term that are done well. Let me see if it's the Svensson one. There was one that lasted like 6 months. But you see, when you look across subjects, a ginormous, that's the scientific term, ginormous variability. So in that study that Barry Swole cited, I've got a quote here that I drew from. This is the highest dose, 25 milligrams per day, increased IGF-1 concentrations, 55 plus or minus 10%. The range being negative 1.5 to 155% at the 2 week mark.
Okay.
And there was actually 88%. I was just looking at the graph. So the values actually on average 88% increase at 4 weeks, but the range was 33 to 202%. So that's really tremendous variability. So what he said, what he found there doesn't really surprise me in the least. He might, if I have to go back and see, you know, exactly what it was I said in that episode. The thing that does happen pretty rapidly is there's a reduced responsiveness in terms of growth hormone release from MK677.
Okay.
So you'll elevate IGF-1 more slowly, and IGF-1 is a very slow responding indicator of nutritional status, as well as growth hormone release, et cetera. So it'll go up, but it's not going to go up in plateau in a matter of days. It's going to be on the order of weeks, which is what happened here. But the growth hormone elevations go down pretty rapidly. And that's what we talked about in the other, I think we've maybe even covered this on 2 episodes now. So there's some adaptation there to in terms of growth hormone release. But it's still going to be elevated enough to maintain that elevation IGF-1. So the thing that I've mentioned on like one discussion board and maybe even on Facebook too is what would happen if someone, because it seems like it's a pretty rapid desensitization, if someone were to use like an every other day type of protocol to try to prevent that. So, you know, give a day or so washout time for the MK677 to occur, and then hit with a big dose again, because you get a pretty substantial increase in growth hormone just from a singular dose.
Okay.
So that might be a way to maintain sensitivity. Who knows? Maybe even reduce the side effects. And overall, because the desensitization is so rapid, you might, on average, maintain higher growth hormone levels doing that. I'm just speculating, just guessing.
Right, right.
That happens, you know. Just think of just something you can notice perceptually, like caffeine use. If you, you know, or start using 600 milligrams of caffeine every single day, people pretty adapt to caffeine use pretty rapidly. You won't even be able to after a week or two, you won't hardly even know, be able to tell that there's any stim effect from the caffeine.
Right.
Pretty much gone. I mean, you can tell if you don't take it because you'll feel pretty groggy. But if you just use that, if you like, let's say you just use 600 milligrams, all of it pre-workout.
Yeah.
Like two or three times a week, you'd be blasting. It's like you'd be like rocket fuel
every time,
every single time. If you just waited a day or two in between doses. And if you're using that, you know, just in that sense where it counts for your workouts, that might be a better way to get the most out of your caffeine, for instance. And with the growth hormone, because the MK677 does promote an increased, so I think it increases both GH spikes and the overall area of the curve for about a day or so, you might be able to get a higher average just using it every other day versus every day. I don't know, but I'd love to see someone test that. It's a hard, like simple shit like that is hard to test with human subject because they have to remember to take it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. For me, that's been my issue. I moved my growth hormone to an every other day protocol and I'll either remember 2 days in a row or forget, you know, that other day. And then it ends up being like one on, two off, that, you know, that type of thing. So I could see that.
Yeah. For someone who's just taking the supplement.
Yeah.
And that's all they're doing, like that stuff. But let's say if you just used it on like leg and back training days, or like if you just train Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or just every other day, and just then you'd know like that's part of your pre-workout ritual, and you're not going to forget to work out.
Right.
That's too much of it, hopefully.
Right.
You just can't take MK677 and get shredded and huge. But so then you'd have a more salient event. You just couple that with your pre-workout protocol, let's say, for instance.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so they'd have to like probably call the adherence would be horrible with an every other day protocol.
Yeah.
I would imagine. So
we need like anyway, we need an app, like a you know, an administration app, like an app to tell you when to administer your stuff. Because that's my problem, honestly, across the board. Is back when I first got into bodybuilding, you know, people talk about how they're like they're excited to take their supplements, and you know, it's like this thing where like I'm excited to take this because I know what it's going to do for me in the long run. And so you're like pumped. And now I'm at the point where I'm like, I'd rather not if I don't have to, you know? Uh-huh. And I need an app that like alerts me every other morning. I can't just set up an alarm on my phone to do that, you know, without going in and doing a lot of planning ahead of time. So,
you don't think you can do that with your phone?
Well, I could set one for every day.
Yeah.
Or I could go through and like program. I think I could go through and program a reminder like manually, you know, through the week. I could do that. But I just want an app that's like, hey, I'm doing, you know, growth every other day and I'm taking a shot Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you know, something like that.
You could do that. You could just program like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Every Monday and every Wednesday, every Friday, you have take growth hormone, inject growth hormone, and then just repeats for indefinitely.
I'll have to figure that out. It sounds like you know a little bit more about technology than I do.
I use the calendar a lot. I've been using like personal digital assistants
like
long before there were even cell phones that would do sort of things since the early 90s. I had an Apple Newton, if people know what those are.
Never heard of it.
And I had a Trio as well. I was like an Apple Newton was like super geeky, like mini Apple computer that you could write notes on. Yeah, it was a personal digital assistant. Huh. It was huge. It's like it was bigger than any cell phone now, a little bit smaller than, it was probably the size of what you might, but like four times as thick as a Kindle.
Oh, wow.
They were pretty big.
Huh.
But you can program those things. I'm sure there's an alternative calendar you could get too. But I've known lots of bodybuilders who need to eat every 2 hours, or they've decided that's what they're going to do to force progress, and they just set their phone to tell them to eat every 2 hours.
So I could see doing that, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of guys have done that over the years.
Keep you on track, that's for sure.
Yeah. Monday, you know, you eat it. I've had like eat at 7, 11, 2, 5, 8. Like that's every 3 hours.
Yeah.
I did that for years.
Yeah. I've set alarms before when I've had a meal, and not for all my meals, but I'll be like, oh, I noticed that my 3 o'clock meal, like when I was working my regular day job before, I'd be like, oh, I get real busy between 2 to 4, and then I end up pushing that back. So I got to remind myself. So I've done that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you could sit your. There you go. That's our million-dollar idea. We're going to have to trim this part of the podcast out so no one steals it.
Gear planner.
Yeah. There, yeah, there you go. Huge planner.
Yeah, I like it.
Yep, the muscle master planner.
We had another question I'm going to go to that's related because it's about GH and IGF levels. And now this is something that we have talked about before in various ways a couple times. I think we can't help but kind of tread over some related territory or ask similar type questions, you know, as time goes on. But I wanted to bring this one back up just kind of as a refresher and because it does kind of tie in since we're in the same area of supplementation. Hi, blokes. Love the work you guys do and can't wait for each episode to come out. This is from Puddinhead, by the way. Says, my question is about the effect of GH in IGF-1 with regards to health and aging. Recent studies on intermittent fasting have shown that the lower levels of IGF-1 in fasted rats has extended their life massively. It also seems that the medical world believes that lower IGF-1 levels reduce the risk of getting many cancers and other related diseases. Question one, why do anti-aging clinics prescribe GH if the result is higher IGF-1 levels? Am I missing some of the benefits of GH? And question two is, what are your thoughts on taking 3 units of growth upon waking and fasting until 1 p.m.? I follow the 8-hour eating window style of diet most days. I plan to start this soon, so any advice would be greatly appreciated.
All right. So, yeah, we did cover the anti-aging thing. And he's right. IGF-1 does not correlate well with cancer risk, but growth hormone levels do decline with age. That's really the main – that was the main impetus for starting up, like I think there used to be pretty popular down in Mexico and for prescribing growth hormone as an anti-aging protocol is that it is a hormone reliably known to decrease as we age.
Yeah.
So that's the main rationale. Of course, body fat goes up as we age. Human or Americans are subject to quote unquote creeping obesity. Mm. And it used to be something like the values have probably worsened, but like at one point after the age of 30, the average American increased body weight till about age of 60 or so. And after that, people who are overweight would start dying off. But in the course of, you know, most of the adult lifetime, the average person would increase body weight by about a pound. But that would include a loss of about a half a pound of fat-free mass during 30 years or so.
Okay.
So that's not a very good change in body composition. So the idea with growth hormone, of course, is that, you know, it's the idea is that it also would promote increase in muscle mass, which the research doesn't suggest, but it does help with body fat. So it's countering at least one part of that change that tends to happen with us as we get older. The idea, of course, would not be to use so much growth hormone. You're using replacement doses to return you to your youthful growth hormone levels, so to speak, even though you can't really replicate, at least easily, normal pulsatile growth hormone.
Okay.
Injectables, and not end up with IGF-1 levels that are sky high, that like, you know, bodybuilders might like want when they're trying to gain exorbitant amounts of muscle mass. So while he's right, let's say someone went into a responsible doc and for whatever reason, and they get growth hormone because their levels were low, and it used to be, and you still can document that medically, that would be documented with low IGF-1. You could literally like fake, I don't know if this would happen now, but you could literally fake the need for a growth hormone prescription by dieting really, really hard. And ending up with low IGF-1 below the normal range. And then the medical rationale would say, well, we're just presumed that you haven't been starving. You're in a, you know, a first world country in the Western world. You got plenty of food. It's not because of that. It's because you have growth hormone deficiencies.
Like sure. Just like with, you could probably do the same with testosterone, a natural guy at the end of contest prep, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, especially, you know, if you didn't actually see the doctor and he doesn't look at you and see, okay, wow, you look like you just came out of a concentration camp or something like that. So the idea would not be that a doctor would like give you growth hormone and then you'd end up with IGF-1 levels that are outside the normal range. Then he would stop doing that, or he would reduce your dose.
Yeah.
So the IGF-1 is definitely a concern. I don't know. I would not be surprised at all. I would have to go and look at the literature. This kind of just occurred to me. But because IGF-1 is representative of nutritional status in general, how well fed you are. And in the least in the later stages of life, when people within years of them actually dying, you'll see a lot of older folks tend to lose a lot of their appetite declines. Obviously all sorts of medical issues come into play. Older folks start eating that IGF-1 will be less as people get older. I wouldn't be surprised if having higher IGF-1, in someone we're talking, after the age of 70, let's say, might be a good predictor of life expectancy. Probably overall, not necessarily if it's exceedingly high as far as cancer goes.
Yeah,
not a good thing. And the IGF-1 relationship with cancer risk is probably more of a lifetime type of issue. I'm kind of speculating here, but it's a somewhat, I hope, educated guess based on, elevated IGF-1 throughout the lifetime, increasing the potential mutagenic effects that IGF-1 would have. But when you're old, you're really old, and you're declining, and you're losing muscle mass and body weight, and you're heading towards, let's say, death from a natural cause, having more IGF-1 would be indicative of someone who's better fed and more robust. More likely to live a longer life. So that, in a GH, an anti-aging doc, might look at it from that perspective. It's like, it's a good idea. You don't have any cancer risks that we're worried about. We're checking on that. We'd want to, give you a GH for that reason. But that would be a pretty weak rationale, I think, for growth hormone use.
Yeah.
So the main thing is, really that it would counter the body fat, the GH decreases. Not a bad thing, of course, for connective tissue health as well. It helps with skin. Mm. Like a lot of those anti-aging clinics you go down to are kind of like spas, you're going down and they're doing TRT and they're doing growth hormone replacement and you're getting massage and maybe you've got a personal trainer who's helping exercise and you're playing tennis, and what have you. So growth hormone can help with skin as well. So that's part of the whole, well, I think what's left, at least, of a lot of those anti-aging clinics that still use growth hormone.
It sounds like that's declining, though, from the way you see it.
I think so. I mean, that's just my perception as a consumer. I haven't tried to look around and, I haven't tracked the, how many anti-aging clinics are popping up.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So what's your thoughts on his second question? And just to reiterate for anybody listening that missed it, it's what are your thoughts on taking 3 units of GH upon waking at 5 a.m. and fasting until 1 p.m. and then follow an 8-hour eating window style of diet on most days?
So as I have mentioned, the what are your thoughts part of questions is like my least favorite way to answer a question because it's so open-ended.
Okay.
What are my thoughts? I can give you a million of them, but I want what you really want to know. So what are his goals here? He's doing an intermittent fasting style protocol. I presume he's trying to lose fat, or is that just, there's lots of reasons why people would do that. He sounds like he's really kind of interested in preventing cancer. Maybe and he wants low IGF-1 levels.
Longevity.
He's got a longevity mission here. So
I can see that.
Yeah. So that's kind of like, when you ask the "what are your thoughts" thing, it's not really necessarily relevant to what he really wants to get at.
And I guess it's not like my first thought is okay. So this might be good for burning fat. This protocol, but is that his goal? I don't know.
So 3 IUs is greater than normal daily production. If he doesn't He's getting up at 5 and he'd be injecting his growth hormone. So the growth hormone would be, that would help with fat burning during that period of time. He probably would, you know, that would probably max out the fat burning that he's going to get during that time, I'm guessing. And the advantage to that, a morning dosing like that, is he may be able to, again, I don't know, I haven't seen this, I've looked and looked and haven't seen this directly investigated, but he may be able to prevent any disruption or a major part of the disruption in nocturnal growth hormone release. Because the growth hormone will be in and out in roughly 8 hours. So by middle of the afternoon, when he started his 8 hour feasting, yeah, at 1 o'clock he starts.
Yeah.
Then, you know, the growth hormone would be gone. That would actually be not a bad thing to avoid some of the acute effects of growth hormone on insulin resistance. So he'll be able to perhaps, especially later in his 8 hour period, have better insulin sensitivity because the growth hormone's not there. And then when he goes to sleep, the growth hormone won't be in his system in a way that feedback inhibits endogenous growth hormone release. So I think that's what he's trying to get at. And 3IUs would probably max out the fat burning. He might, at least during that period. So it sounds like he's kind of trying to juggle his insulin sensitivity by keeping the dose to once a day and maintain endogenous release to some degree. And like I said, keep the insulin sensitivity when he's taking in his carbs and his food, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So let's see here. I had some more notes. I mean, the thing with intermittent fasting is it's not the best way to gain muscle. There's actually one study that showed it can have a negative impact on thyroid metabolism, even when you keep calories the same.
I had wondered that. It seems like, yeah, because you're not giving your body anything to ramp up with.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're sort of, I mean, this is a teleological, you know, pseudo-environmental, or a sort of, you know, look at how the body might be thinking about this, you know, sort of, is that, well, we're only getting food 8 hours a day. We should probably ramp down metabolism because there's a scarcity of food.
Sure, sure. You know,
that's sort of the idea that would be behind that. And there's one study that suggests, I think TSH went down, is what happened over the course. The thyroid was reduced in the intermittent fasting group. I could look that up and maybe post that if you want to know. But it doesn't what's come out so far, at least that I'm aware of, it doesn't really point to intermittent fasting being a great way to gain muscle mass. And you can negatively impact your thyroid. If for a lot of people, I've heard this many times now, it's easy and it's structured. So it can help kind of keep some bookends on people's eating that makes it easy for them, but it can also, push them over the edge in terms of, what you would actually kind of called disordered eating. An orthorexic type of approach. Have you heard that term before, Scott?
I've heard it before, but can you define that for me?
Yeah. So I think the word ortho means like straight up and down.
Okay.
Orthogonal. And yeah, so orthorexia is the idea that people have to have absolute and utter complete order. Like bodybuilding, almost by definition, for many people, like when you're pre-contest, it will necessitate some level of orthorexia.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You have to be very, you know, structured and disciplined, and you have to pay attention to your calories, and you know, every last little morsel matters if you're trying to push the limits of your ability to drop body fat and get in shape. So for some people, like, doing this it can lead to more disordered eating, because then they just end up like it creates sort of a binge binge eating type of phenomenon.
Sure.
So you got to watch out for that. But so that's kind of all I can give him on the growth hormone thing without knowing what his goals are and why he wants to do this. You know, yeah. It's kind of like someone saying, you know, what do you think about buying a dually, you know, pickup truck? And I'm like, well,
what's your goal?
What's your goal? Like, what do you need the truck for? Yeah. You know,
driving across country? Maybe not.
Right. So Yeah, that always matters. So we can keep on making that note. Some people do a really good job of tossing that in, but it would be really helpful here to help him out more.
Okay. White Ox has a question. What effect could a PDE5 inhibitor like Cialis have on fat loss due to increased blood flow, for example? Let's say you combine it with Yohimbine or Clen. In regards to your recent talk on mini cuts, what is your view on refeeds and higher carb days? That's actually a second question. So right. I'll leave that separate. I guess we'll start with the Cialis and PDE5 inhibitors. Is there anything for fat loss here, Scott?
I Googled around. There actually is a if you use a PDE, a phosphodiesterase type 3, a PDE3 inhibitor, that can limit the anti-lipolytic action of insulin. So if he wants to use a PDE inhibitor, Cialis, as far as I can tell, wouldn't be the best one. If you can find there are drugs out there that are PDE3 inhibitors,
okay,
that could do that. So I think his idea, the thing that, you know, that sort of made sense, I don't even know if he knows this, but made sense to me, is that lipolysis, at least during exercise, in particular, is a function of blood flow to the adipose tissue.
Mm.
So you need to have adipose tissue blood flow. If that is key and requisite for delivery of catecholamines that promote lipolysis, for instance, during exercise. So that's super important. And if blood flow is limited to the adipose, then you won't get fatty acid liberation from that adipose tissue. So that was kind of his idea. But the PDE3 does a better job, at least in terms of attenuating insulin-induced reduction in lipolysis. So,
are you familiar with any medications that are PDE3 inhibitors that we would be familiar with? Because
in this particular study, which is entitled "Various Phosphodiesterase Subtypes Mediate the In Vivo Anti-Lipolytic Effect of Insulin on Adipose Tissue and Skeletal Muscle in Man," and they used amrinone. Addition of the selective PDE3 inhibitor amrinone, amrinone, abolished insulin-induced decrease in adipose glycerol concentration, but did not influence the glycerol. So glycerol, when you break down a triglyceride, triacylglycerol, you get glycerol release, and the fatty acids are released too. So they were measuring, this particular study, the glycerol, the decrease in glycerol that insulin would typically cause, because insulin inhibits fatty acid, inhibits lipolysis.
Okay. So
it inhibits glycerol release, and this amrinone abolished the insulin-induced decrease in adipose glycerol concentration. So they're just measuring actually the glycerol in the adipocytes, because you normally would have glycerol, it wouldn't be free, it'd be bound up as a triacylglycerol, as a triglyceride.
Okay.
So nor did the PDE4 selective inhibitor ralipram or the PDE5 selective inhibitor dipyramidol influence the insulin-induced decrease in muscle tissue glycerol. So the PDE5 selective inhibitor, which is what Cialis is, did not have this effect. So
okay. So
that's what I found.
And just Googling PDE3 inhibitor, I'm reading that at least some of them, it says, are used for acute heart failure, which I guess very different than what we're using Cialis for in most cases.
Well, what we're using, that's actually how they found Viagra.
Okay.
Yeah. The origin of Viagra was they were looking at ways to treat angina, and potentially which could be caused by a poor blood flow in the coronary arteries. So ways to open those up and help prevent the possibility of a myocardial infarction. So they were giving Viagra. I think the study was basically just for people who were who had cardiovascular disease, who were experiencing angina on a regular basis, and they were asking them to report the incidence, frequency, and the extent of their angina pectoris symptoms, how the chest pains they're getting, and they asked, like, what other side effects were you having? And, like, all these guys kept on saying, I'm getting lots of erections.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, we can maybe make use of this drug somehow, some other way. And that, and that's Viagra was born, and then Cialis was born of that. In this particular study, the one I just mentioned, it also adds, however, the non-selective PDE inhibitor theophylline counteracted the anti-lipolytic action of insulin at both sites. Muscle and fat being those two sites. So theophylline is found in tea.
Okay.
Yeah, you can buy that by itself. Theophylline and theobromine and caffeine are all structurally related.
I've heard of that before. Do they sell that as a supplement on its own?
Yeah, I think you can get like bulk supplements and places like that will sell it to you.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Very different show here than like Blood, Sweat, and Gear, because I don't think we could have gotten through this conversation saying the word angina and talking about Viagra in the same. We couldn't have gotten through that with Skip here. It just wouldn't have. Yeah.
Well, with Skip, well,
I don't even know. I don't even know. But there would have been some sort of rim shot in there, some sort of comedy punchline, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we would be talking about dick sizes and, you know.
Right.
Shit, right?
Exactly.
Are you a shower or yeah. You know the rest of that one.
Yeah. So he says that, you know, in regards to your recent talk on mini cuts, what is your view on refeeds, higher carb days periodically during these periods, considering you are in deep deficit and pretty flat and depleted? Wouldn't it help you preserve more muscle mass and keep performance higher? Scott, I'm going to jump in here because this is one I know I can. We're getting away from the PE3s and the PDE5 inhibitors. I can chime in here, so I'm going to take that opportunity. Yes. That's my answer. Yes. I mean, as long as you're still losing fat, right? I mean, the key is to, I think that if you get too flat, you know, that's going to be a problem too. It's a balance, right? So we deplete, and in that process, you become more and more flat. And I always, my mental analogy that I came up with is like the sponge. And I don't know, stop me if I told you this one before, Scott. I look at muscle as like a sponge. Sponge being like, think of like your sponge you have in your bucket in the garage. And if filling out is the goal, we think of the sponge being like in the spring, we haven't washed our car through the winter in Michigan because it's too cold. We go to an auto car wash or something. But in the spring, you get that sponge out and you submerge it in the water, and it's resistant at first. And over time, you know, that the sponge will soak up water, and then it becomes more likely to soak up water the next time you go to wash your car next week, because it's not quite as dried out as it had been before. And it's just the picture I've had in my mind that I like to make sure that people can still fill out while they're dieting. So we diet them down, and we kind of dry the sponges out, and they kind of shrink down, and then we fill them back up. And as long as, you know, if you wait too long, it's going to take longer. It's going to take more. It's going to be more of a process to fill that muscle back out. So I just always want to try to keep that balance of making it so that you can still fill back out. But of course, you know, working the fat loss hard enough to reach your goals in time. I don't know. That's my weird little picture in my brain.
I like the sponge theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
That's I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about if it's a theory as much as just this visual picture I have. Because you know what I mean, Scott? Like, and this is specific more to like contest prep. Like, I talked a lot about this last contest with my legs, with Skip in particular, because I always said, like, oh, I think my legs lose mass, they lose size, I lose, quote, muscle. And his thought was, no, you're probably not losing muscle, you're just getting depleted and not able to fill them back out. And so the balance was me trying to make sure I could still fill out completely. And part of that is making sure I don't dry the sponges out too far. Don't leave them in the bucket, you know, in the dry bucket all winter long, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that really directly relates to that, I wish there were some direct data on skeletal muscle cells, but the hydration state of cells is very important for its anabolic slash catabolic state. So the protein balance in a cell can be shifted. You can do this in vitro. You can do it in a cell culture. They'll just change the osmotic concentrations of the culture medium, and that will crenate, shrink down the cell, or they can expand the cell, and that will change the protein balance in the cell. You can basically dramatically shift the cell metabolism
just through hydration alone.
Yeah, it's just through hydration alone. It's very important in liver cells, for instance.
I'll be damned.
There's a guy named Heusinger, Heusinger,
okay,
who's done a lot of research on this. I'm sure it's cited in my book if people have the book. It's actually cited in the Fortitude Training book, I think, as well. So having a well hydrated cell is important. In fact, some of the actions of insulin seem to be related to cell hydration. Yeah, and like one thing, of course, that happens with glycogen load is that there's an osmotic effect, so cells fill up. So that's a helpful aspect of staying well glycogen loaded as well as you possibly can while you're dieting down. And if you get if glycogen levels get too low, which would also mean that cell volume is going to be lower, but that's associated with a negative protein balance. Skeletal muscle cells. So the Heusinger work has never been done that I know of directly with muscle cells or muscle cells in culture.
Yeah.
But it's been done with all sorts of other cells. So there's probably something there.
That's fascinating. I like that.
That's why a lot of guys, with their legs too, a lot of guys will stop training legs like well over even a week before a show.
Oh, yeah.
Because they find they fill out eventually over time. If someone is like just bombarded your legs and they're really sore, the muscle damage will prevent glycogen filling.
If you can get somebody ready early too. And this last year, and it still is this year, I guess, Scott, it's, the end of December, but this year has for me as a coach been awesome because I've been, instead of trying to time people up for the show, I've been planning them a lot earlier. And then, years and years ago, I was afraid that you would miss the peak then. That you would diet someone down and they would hit their peak and you couldn't get that back. But now I see you just get them in shape and then you have them do less cardio, and that's what I'm getting at is with less wear, less movement, less walking, less shuffling, that's helped a lot to allow people to fill back out, in the legs,
Absolutely. Yeah. Someone, especially if they're doing a lot of cardio.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that issue because I just walk the dogs.
Yeah.
my cardio most of the time. There's not a whole lot of that, but yeah, for sure, man.
Had you ever gotten into a point where you did a lot of cardio in your bodybuilding?
I did, yeah. At the very beginning, when my very first show, I did a massive amount of cardio.
Do you remember like how much out of curiosity?
Yeah, I almost exactly, just because I've mentioned before, I did 2 hours a day every day for 7 days a week for 14 weeks.
I do remember you saying that now.
Something like that. I think it was 14. Yeah, it was an hour. I got up, I do an hour, and then I go train, and then I come back and do another hour, and I did that every single day.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was okay. I don't remember like it being just was doing what I need to do. I felt like I needed to do.
Sure. Well, you could do anything if that's what you have to do, right? If that's what you believe in.
Pretty close. Well, not everyone could, but yeah, a lot of people can do just amazing things. So I just have a better tolerance for not eating and kind of suffering through that, because I just don't I don't have like any issues with just not eating food, really. I just, and maybe some of it maybe came from anyone who was a wrestler can identify with this, like when I was a wrestler, I wrestled in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, I think it was going into my 9th grade year. I'm mixing it up, but I think it was 8th grade. I wrestled 135, started at like 132 and then went to 135. They give you some weight for growth, throughout the season.
Yeah.
And then the next year I came back and I was starting to have my growth spurt and I weighed like 147 or something like that when the season started. And they said, well, you're going to have to wrestle 121 if you want to wrestle.
Okay.
Because now you're, so I'm like, okay, that's a lot of weight. You want me to drop 26 pounds?
Yeah.
So I would get up in the morning and I would have an orange, and then I'd go to school and I'd go wrestle, wrestling practice, and I'd come home and I'd have a Diet Coke and I'd sit with my parents and we had family dinner. I wouldn't eat anything. And then I would go and do my schoolwork for a few hours and go to sleep. And the next day, just to mix it up, I would get a 1 cup of cornflakes with a half a cup of skim milk.
You had it measured out to a half.
Yeah, well, that's just like that's I don't know that was like what the serving size was. I think it's like with a half cup. That's maybe how it was on the. I didn't know. I didn't fucking know what to do. I just was like trying. I knew I had to lose weight, so that's all I would eat. I did that for like a couple months.
Dang.
Yeah, I was like literally that was, I don't know, an orange was maybe 80 calories and the other food was, you know.
And that was it.
That was it. That's all I'd eat. And then like with 3 hours of wrestling, wrestling's fucking brutal.
Yeah, yeah.
No food at lunch, nothing, like just I'd have a Diet Coke at night. I remember sometimes I'd have two. I'd come home and I did what a lot of wrestlers do. I've got a friend who's now working with an old school wrestler who's an older guy, and he does this, used to do the same thing. I wouldn't drink any water during wrestling practice.
Okay.
Like at all. Despite whether we were in the hot room or like wearing all the clothes, because I wanted to see what my weight would be dehydrated, so I have a good idea of where I could weigh in when I was dehydrated.
Yeah.
And I just, because I'm sort of wired this way, to be stupid, I guess, I wouldn't drink anything. I would like I weigh in after practice and I wouldn't drink anything until I got home.
Oh
so
my
I
God.
Would go to the drinking fountain. So I'd sit there and remember there were times like when the snow was coming down and that sort of thing. And, you know, it would take a while for Mama to get there literally because she had to like, my dad had to like get home from work maybe and shovel the drive so she could get the car out and that kind of shit.
Yeah.
She'd come pick me up and then well, I wouldn't drink anything and I'd get home and then I would go. I was so thirsty I could go to like the fridge where the Diet Cokes were and I could slam a whole Diet Coke like with one gulp.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, easy. Like carbonation didn't bother me in the least.
You said that you were waiting for your mom and it was snowing. I thought you were going to say you would start catching snowflakes on your tongue.
Just sit there, you know, and it just I remember being like watching the other kids lap down the water. For some reason, I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. And
I'm above that. I don't need water.
I'm not even sure why I did it, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But anyway, so like after that, like a bodybuilding diet was pretty easy. So I think I kind of strengthened my mind as far as those things go. And so that I can save time, not spend time doing cardio and just eat less.
Yeah.
And then I started recognizing that there's a, you know, you're sending the opposite signal, for muscle mass when you're doing cardio.
Hmm.
And my legs would get smaller when I did cardio, you know, so, I couldn't train as hard. My strength would go down. So I'm like, I'm going to try this without cardio. Just suffer more.
That's interesting. Stuff about hydration and muscle growth is interesting too. And it makes total sense. And I mean, even just like on a real basic level, Scott, like if I just look at it, you know, as just a bro that lifts weights, when do I feel best, if I'm hydrated or dehydrated, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you absolutely should be as hydrated as possible. Like when you're dieting down. You really should.
My therapist that does FST, it's much like ART. She's mm-hmm. predominantly worked on strongmen. That's her main calling. And she has a contract with the Detroit Lions too. She started working with me and she hadn't worked with many bodybuilders. And since then, it's kind of opened up like a whole new demographic of clientele for her. You know, I've talked about her on the show and, you know, my friends have suggested people and she's working on a lot more bodybuilders now. Shout out to Becky over at Tricuffery. She's awesome.
Yo, Becky, what's up?
She's cool. You would like her too, Scott. She's real passionate about learning.
Awesome.
She said that now that she's working with bodybuilders, the big thing she sees is different. And she thought it was just me at first. She said is like our muscles are not nearly as hydrated as other people, normal people, the strongmen. Mm. The football players. She said that the hydration in our muscles across the board is generally lower, and that causes, as you can imagine, all sorts of issues with working on us and with potential injury.
Mm-hmm. You know, I heard, speaking of blood, sweat, and gear, I heard you guys answer the question about that. Maybe the person who asked it was the same person Skip was talking about, or maybe two different people, where the guy had gotten a bunch of cramps when he'd carb up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was that Skip's client, or did Skip say he had a client who was a diabetic who like ended up going to the hospital once after a skip load?
Okay, now the guy who wrote in was not Skip's client.
Okay.
I can't remember if Skip's client was diabetic, but Skip had a client that had gone through similar stuff. And you know what, Scott? I've noticed that too, where I would eat a cheat meal and be fine, and then and like no cramping through the week. I have the cheat meal, and then later that night, I get cramping.
Yeah, well, I've had that tendency too.
And, okay.
One of the things, I mean, I was listening to those guys answer the question. I think they kind of touched upon it, but insulin can cause hypokalemia, and I'm pretty sure that Ken may even use that exact term. It can reduce potassium levels.
Yeah.
And there's actually one piece of research showing that you can't glycogen load properly if potassium in the diet is restricted. Glycogen, it just won't happen. Because part of that so the osmotic effect of glycogen has to happen, or the glycogen synthesis has to happen in concert with an increase in cell volume. The two things go hand in hand, and that increase in cell volume is mediated through an increase in potassium. Potassium is one of the main intracellular positively charged electrolytes.
Okay.
So those two things all go hand in hand. So if you have someone, for instance, who's been depleted for quite a while, they're highly insulin sensitive, and they have a bunch of carbohydrate rich food that produces a high glycemic response and a high insulin index, and they get a really good glycogen loading effect, they can end up with low blood calcium levels. And that can precipitate the spasming. So that actually happened to me like literally a couple of days after I listened to that podcast. And I had that issue before when I trained legs.
Can you explain that last part one more time for me, please?
Sure.
Just because I didn't catch it exactly.
Oh, it's all good. So when glycogen storage happens, you've got an increase in the cell size.
Right.
Glycogen is a protein that's stored in conjunction with glycogen.
Okay.
Produces this osmotic effect that pulls water into the cell. And that's even more so than the glycogen itself is what causes the increase in fullness that you get when you glycogen load or supercompensate, like when you're carbing up for a show.
Yeah, AKA so, you're swole at this point.
When you're getting swole, yeah. And the value of three grams of water per gram of glycogen or what have you, that actually, the origin of that is in liver cells in rats, is where that number comes from. If you look at Mike Sherman, who was at Ohio State at the time, did some research where he tried to evaluate whether that ratio holds in skeletal muscle in human beings when they're glycogen loading, and it did not. It's highly variable. I don't recall in that paper whether he was looking at potassium as a mediator of the extent to which water makes its way into the muscle cell along with the glycogen.
Okay. So you carb up basically. Now the muscle is filled with water, glycogen.
Water and glycogen. And along with that, and what has to happen, this is what this other piece of research, this is all actually all this is cited in at least I know of the articles that I've written for John Meadow's site on carving up. And there's the Peak Week articles, which are in my book. It's actually in my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book too, I'm pretty sure, on glycogen loading and the necessity for potassium. So there's one study, a clinical study, where they looked at glycogen loading in skeletal muscle. And when you restrict potassium, you will prevent that glycogen loading from happening.
Okay.
So if you're not allowing the cell to have enough potassium to mediate the increase in water that needs to happen alongside the increase in glycogen, then the whole process comes to a halt. You need potassium, you want water, and you want carbs, and insulin is mediating this increase in potassium inside the cell. It's one of the things it's doing. There's a sodium-potassium pump that's involved here.
Okay.
So that's activated by insulin. So that's moving electrolytes. And potassium is the intracellular electrolyte that's the main one inside cells. So, and the thing that I mentioned initially was that insulin can cause hypokalemia, and that's because it's pulling. Kalemia refers to potassium levels in the blood. So the low potassium levels in the blood can occur with insulin use or in diabetics, or just through, in our case, what we're talking about here, having a lot of insulin, at least when you've carved up, or a lot of glycogen storing, because that potassium is ending up inside the muscle cell.
You're shuttling, okay, so you're shuttling, and I got you now, the potassium out of your blood into the muscle cell, therefore in your blood now you have it's lower.
You're deficient in
potassium. I'll be damned. Now this is, okay, thank you for saying it again, because I get it now.
Yeah, sure. So, and that's when you're going to have an issue with neurons, motor neurons, the ones that will be spontaneously depolarizing, much to your chagrin, and giving you cramps when you don't want them.
Hmm.
And I'm pretty sure there's also a residual effect from the training you've done, because this happens in my legs after I've trained legs and
or
upper body. You tend to have it there. And people will tend to get spasms even if, you know, they haven't done any crazy glycogen loading or dietary manipulations. So some of that can just be because those neurons have been impacted because of the high activity levels from the training. And there can be some, neurons, like if you look at a motor neuron that goes down, so one neuron will, in a motor unit, will innervate a number of muscle cells. It could be 10 in the eye or hundreds in the quad, depending on what the muscle's function are. But if you go back to the spinal cord, in the anterior gray matter of the spinal cord where that motor neuron's located, you can see that there are thousands of neurons that impinge upon it. And some of those are neurons that are sensory neurons coming back from the skeletal muscle, like the ones that are coming back from like stretch receptors. So if you've got a muscle that you've just beat the shit out of, and you've got chemoreceptors, like what are known as type 3 and type 4 afferents that feed back from the muscle, those feed back and send input to those motor neurons. And they can be bringing those motor neurons closer to the threshold for depolarization and sending their signal. Hmm. And so you've got an irritated muscle that's feeding back to the spinal cord, telling the alpha motor neuron that activates that area of the muscle. Or part of the muscle, hey, like we just suffered some main issue. We've got some disruption here. So the alpha motor neuron's a little bit wonky in the first place.
Yeah.
And then you deplete the blood of potassium levels and throw off the normal balance of intra and extracellular electrolytes. You've got an electrolyte issue. And there's probably other things that are going on. Your kidneys are going to have to handle this in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, if you're not taking in enough potassium to replenish that which is now inside the skeletal muscles, because you've just loaded really, really well, you were really glycogen sensitive because you didn't have any carbs all week long and you trained really hard and you took in a bunch of sugary, high insulin index foods, and you don't get a lot of potassium in those, then you've got an issue. But what you can do is just, you know, make sure you have enough potassium in those foods. And you were just take a potassium supplement, 99 milligram potassium supplement, which you can get at the drugstore. A few of those, I usually would use like sea salt, which has some trace minerals in it, and like a chelated multi-mineral, just to be sure. And that'll fix you up right up. And taurine, of course, quinine, which you'll get in tonic water, also helps. But I what happened to me, a couple of days of hearing that podcast was I was back up in Tampa, I was at my house, and I was getting ready to leave the next day. So I went and I trained legs, and because everything's just sort of cattywampus with the house being in disrepair, I was up on my feet, and I don't have a functioning kitchen, so I was out in the RV cooking and walking back and forth trying to multitask. So on my feet walking around, I didn't eat until late, and I literally was eating my food like while I was working.
Yeah.
Oh, that probably wasn't helping. And then I had a couple things of sorbet because I got a little behind on my food. And sorbet this was another indication of why it works so well for loading me up is I think it gives me a really high insulin spike.
Okay.
When I have sorbet during these carb ups, I tend to get the cramps more often.
Huh.
unless I take care of supplementing with minerals and potassium. So I was lying in bed. I was tired and I got a little bit of a cramp start. I'm like, okay, I just went and had some sea salt. I was gonna worry about all my kitchen stuff has been cleaned out and it's in a back room.
Oh man.
And it's all like semi-organized. I know as I go through it, I'll know where to put things, but I don't remember where everything is because I just moved that out as quickly as I could. So I went to go to sleep and I started getting – I get the cramps in my sartorius most typically. I started getting in my hamstrings and my calves. I'm like, fuck. So I went to get up and I'm on this like little trundle bed, which is like low to the ground. I went to squat down and both my sartorius – went bonkers and my hamstrings. I'm like, oh shit. Oh fuck. So I stood up, I had to straighten out. And when I contracted my quad, my right quad just went like a motherfucker. So my dogs were like, what the hell's going on? I was literally screaming. I was scared I was going to tear my quad.
Oh God.
Yeah. But I'm like, okay, I know what to get. But I had to walk to the other side of the house like that.
Yeah.
And I'm laughing and I'm crying at the same time because it hurts so bad.
Yeah.
And I couldn't remember where all my stuff was. I knew I had it, like all the stuff, like the Peak Week anti-cramping stuff was all in one bag.
Oh, you weren't planning on needing that stuff right now.
I didn't think I was going to need it. No, but I knew roughly where it was. And it's all down on the ground. So I'm trying to bend over and get this shit. I can't squat down.
Yeah, yeah.
Squatting down is like a total no-go. Because my quad, it's like, I'm actually really kind of concerned I'm going to tear my quad. It's contracting so hard.
Yeah.
So eventually I found it. And then, well, here's the funny part. Look, we'll just go with this story here. We're a little off track, but it's fine. So then I'm like, I got to take care of this as soon as I can. So I actually had some tonic water. So I must have drank about a half a liter of tonic water. And then I had a bunch, like I had like at least 2 liters of water. I was pouring the sea salt into my mouth.
It only
took a few minutes to get rid of it, but you know, I just wanted to like make it stop.
Yeah, yeah.
And I probably had like 8 grams of taurine and like another like, you know, half, at least a half a dozen multi-minerals. And I didn't have any potassium. I don't think I couldn't find it if I did, but I had some of the multi-minerals, so that was fine, but no straight potassium. So I load all that shit in and then the cramps were gone. I was fine. Like literally within 5 minutes, not a problem.
Oh, I'm sure you probably had enough minerals in you for like 3 to 5 days, you know?
But I did. Well, until I had the shits the next day, because by the time it got down to my colon, I had osmotic diarrhea.
Oh, God.
Because, you know, I didn't absorb all that stuff, you know? So it was pulling water into my gut.
Yeah.
And then I had the shits. So I was just laughing. I'm like, oh, man. I knew, like, when I lie down, I'm like, oh, my GI is not going to like me after all that. I'm going to pay for this again. Yeah. So. Anyway, as far as how the hell do we get on the refeed and the carving up? So that's one of the things I'm glad I had an opportunity to toss that out, is that that's a mechanism that's involved with people who get that phenomenon and a multi-mineral or some potassium supplementation. Don't do a whole bottle. You don't want to take in that much potassium. That's why they put those in 99 milligram doses, because you can screw up your heart rhythm if you go bonkers.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe if you have that issue, you might try those things. Quinine is in tonic water, diet tonic water, taurine, you know, a few grams of taurine, a couple multi-minerals, you know, assuming they have potassium, and then a little, make sure you salt your food, and just assuming you have healthy kidneys, your kidneys will sort out those minerals if and when the insulin release is causing any reduction in blood potassium. You'll be able to take care of that by the supplementation.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Oh man. Well, that gives me some insight, because I still didn't quite understand it after we discussed it on Blood, Sweat, and Gear. But I was at least happy to know that I wasn't alone, and what was going on in my situation had made sense. You know, that other people had gone through the same thing. But now I get it. Now I understand what's happening. The potassium gets pulled from your bloodstream, delivered to the muscle, leaving your potassium low in the blood. Which, yeah, that's cool, man.
That's what, you know, at least could very well be happening. But that's my guess. Except given, especially that potassium will help remedy that. But his question about refeeds. I have a whole chapter on this in my book too.
Okay.
A plug for the book, but what did he say? He said, considering a deep deficit pre-depleted, wouldn't it help preserve muscle mass and keep forms higher? he asked another open-ended question, like, what is your view on refeeds, higher carb days periodically during these periods? So the stricter your diet, I think you touched on this, the larger your refeed could and would be. So your goals, it depends on what you're trying to do with them, but you're wanting to at least to replenish glycogen, for instance, and provide an anabolic effect to skeletal muscle that may indeed counter whatever catabolic effect muscle mass you might have lost. So like with someone who's doing like a, like the skip loads probably do this, or someone who does like your standard 5-2 cyclical ketogenic diet where you've got 5 days of ketosis and 2 days of carbing back up. Yeah. You may be having an advantage there because the refeeds are providing an anabolic effect. So the stricter your diet is, the larger your refeed would be. And like when Ken does his skip loads, he typically, the skip loads become, in many cases, I think, hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn for him, but I'm pretty sure that most people end up doing more massive skip loading as they get deeper into a diet.
As long I think as so. On track. Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. The longer you do a refeed, the less your daily caloric excess would be. So if you're going to refeed for a day, you can pretty much go friggin' bonkers. And, you know, you can't do too much damage unless you're just like, you know, like a champion, you know, competitive eater type person.
Yeah.
And I don't know how those guys do that shit. That's a whole other topic. There's been like, there was a guy who did a 100,000 calorie challenge. This is a video on YouTube I saw not too long ago. That's like 25. He did 25,000 calories a day for 4 days, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, I mean, so he's just like, okay, so 3,500 calories in a pound of body fat. You know, how's this guy not gaining dozens of pounds of body fat unless he's throwing up, unless he's purging this stuff, you know? It's just like, I don't know what's going on there. It makes me wonder what's going on behind the camera when the camera's off. But anyway, that's an aside. In your refeed, this is just sort of things taken from the book. Or that I've covered in the book, is you'd want to make that something that replenishes whatever fuel source you may be low in. So if you've been doing a low-carb diet, which what a lot of people have done, you're going to have a high-carb refeed. High carbs are going to be especially better for instance, restoring leptin levels. But if you're someone who's done like a low-fat approach, which people do, it's not a bad idea to throw your fats in there. As well, if you're someone who might even be like low on essential fatty acids. So you could even have some higher fats in a refeed, which Ken does, I think, a lot of times now. Some of the refeeds he posted on Elite FTS were just literally sick. Yeah. It's not skinning like some of those IHOP and burgers and shit.
Yeah, he posts them on his social media too.
Oh, they're crazy, man.
A lot of food.
Yeah. The thing about refeeds I tell people too is you got to watch out for the an abstinence violation effect, which is the what the fuck effect. I think we talked about it here on this podcast. Yeah,
that, the name sounds familiar, but remind me what that effect is.
So it comes from like health behavior research where people have been abstaining from something. In this case, you'd have been abstaining from eating the food you want to eat because you're dieting.
Right.
And when you violate that abstinence. Meaning like if you're someone who in like more in addiction scenarios, like you're someone who's quit smoking or doesn't drink or whatever it may be, once you violate that period of abstinence, meaning you start to smoke, you start to drink, or in this scenario, you have a bunch of food and eat till you feel full.
Right.
And you can sort of fall off the wagon. You'd be like, you just have like, oh, what the fuck?
Oh,
you
know? Yeah. That I remember it now. Yeah.
You just keep going. So that can happen. To people, and then you end up, even if it only lasts for like a day, and then like the guilt kicks in,
right?
You know, or you spill over so bad that you're like, oh shit, I think I fucked up. Well, then you're already fucked up. Like, you know, an extra day of like absolute gluttony can indeed undo a whole day, a whole week's worth of dieting.
Sure.
So some people are going to have to plan them out, plan the refeeds out, like. A smart, like a thing that I typically do, or I'll have clients do a lot of times is like pick like the meals they really like for the refeed, which they'll probably continue to like as the diet goes on because they like them in the first place and they'll get more and more hungry as things progress, and just stick to those. So like if you have like a sushi refeed meal, you just have that sushi refeed meal. If you're doing like Five Guys burgers, then you just like do, you know, two double bacon cheeseburgers, if that's what your refeed meal is for you, that works for you based on your diet and or psychologically. And that's it. So you're still structured. It's not a free for all.
Right.
Which some people, you know, the story of Dave Tate when he worked with Justin Harris.
I don't know if I know his story.
It's on YouTube somewhere. It's been quite a few years ago now, but Justin Harris coached Dave to get into shape.
Okay. After
retired from powerlifting, and you'll see pictures on the site still of Dave, and he was—I mean, you can see all the kind of the torn muscles that he has, but he's still pretty fucking. He's still really big, and he got really lean. He got into single-digit body fat percentage.
Okay.
Somewhere along the line, there, like, because Justin does a carb cycling approach, he was having him do refeeds, and they were like timed refeeds, like, you know, you have. I think it was like number of meals or something like that. I can't remember exactly how Justin phrased it, but basically, what Dave was doing is like he said, well, as long as I don't, if I can consider it like one meal, as long as I don't stop eating.
Hmm.
So he would just like keep the food flowing for hours.
Oh yeah!
Like,
wow.
Chocolate chips or M&Ms and that kind of shit.
I've heard like, similar type stories before.
Yeah, I know there have been many cases. That was the first time I can remember, and the way, of course, Dave tells it, it's hilarious.
But, I bet.
Yeah, he just totally, you know, totally fucking rationalizes a way around cheating on the diet. He knew exactly what Justin meant. He just wanted to be a dick. And, find a reason to. It's pretty funny now in retrospect. But so people will need to some people need to structure it. Let's see what else I got. And the last thing that I have this all in the book. I may post this on Instagram. I got a little infographic on refeed rules of thumb. Is that if you're dieting down, let's say for a show, you might as well use the refeeds as a way to practice your carb up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what I typically kind of do with people. It's like, you know, if you're going to use pancakes, like you're going to bring your own pancakes to the show that you made at home, then, you know, start making those pancakes and start using those.
Absolutely.
So figure out which foods, and then your GI gets used to those foods.
Yeah. No surprises at the end.
Right. Right. You don't try to eat something that, you know, sends you to the toilet. So those are my thoughts on the refeeds.
Right on.
At least the overview of it.
Well, this puts a lot of information together. I think this is a good show, and I think this is a good place for us to cut out. I know we're coming up here on Christmas. Let me see.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to look at my calendar because I think next week is Christmas.
Eight days away from Christmas.
8 days away. So this is our lead into Christmas episode, and we'll have to discuss what we want to do the following week when we record. Because traditionally we would record on what is New Year's Eve. And I don't know if you have any big plans or what's going on, but what I'm saying is, no matter what, the next episode of Muscle Minds will be in January 2019.
That's right. It'll come out. Yeah. Wow. Oh, Happy New Year.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this show with me. It's been a blast, and I look forward to seeing what we could do with it in the future.
Dude, you make this so easy. I mean, all I got to do is come on here and blab, and then you take care of all the heavy lifting in the background. Phenomenal.
Awesome. Well, we make a good team, and I'm happy to do it.
All right, my friend. Well, Happy New Year. We'll obviously talk before, but Happy New Year, everyone.
Absolutely. Happy New Year, guys, and I'm sure I will talk to you before that time, everybody, and you, Scott. Guys, for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. We will see you soon.
Adios.
All right.
Cool.
Advices Radio Network.